Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. With you every weekend, each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget how much our freedom costs. And along the way, we learn a thing or two. Sometimes we learn about battles. Sometimes we learn about close calls. Sometimes some brushes with some famous faces. That'll certainly be the case today. And some of the most moving moments we've had on the show, I think, are from people who came face to face with some of the most ugly parts of World War II. And we're going to hear about a concentration camp today from someone who saw the aftermath with his own two eyes. 88-year-old Mel Friedman, all the way from Boca Raton, Florida, is our guest today. I want to thank his son-in-law, decorated Vietnam veteran Terry Fox, for letting me know about Mel. Terry, treating you all right in your visit out to California here, Mel?
Better than you should.
I'm going to have to ask some follow-ups on that one. And I think as people listen to you, they're going to realize that by the northeastern accent that still lingers, you're not from Florida originally. You're a Massachusetts boy. Natick, Mass?
Natick, Mass.
What was it like there as you were growing up?
A rural town, about 13,000 people, if you include all environs. It was pretty much agricultural till the railroad came through, and then the railroad gave way to shoe factories, and my dad owned a rubber factory in the town. And in fact, he had several businesses.
You were a pretty good football player, I understand.
Well, I played.
Well, you were being recruited by my alma mater, Syracuse, and by some school called Notre Dame, but you decided to go to Harvard instead, eventually. Your mother decided that. Sorry, I got that wrong. Since you played so much football, how different was the football you played from what we see on television today?
Oh, my goodness. There wasn't a single person that I played with, probably exception of one, that could have even played college football today. College football today has changed so dramatically. They're bigger, faster, stronger. Training, equipment, everything is so advanced. It's like we had telephones we had to crank when we were kids, and now you walk around pressing buttons. So that's what football changed. That's how much it changed. The game that didn't change as dramatically was hockey.
But you guys didn't wear helmets in hockey back then, probably, huh?
No, and I didn't wear a face piece in football either, a face mask, because that was a sign of cowardice. And I wore plain glasses. I played hockey playing just wearing just regular glasses.
Never broke your glasses?
Well, it got bent. I never got any glass in my eyes. I was fortunate. Got them knocked off and, you know, broken a few times. But no, I never had real accidents with them.
Sounds like you enjoyed those contact sports, football and hockey, huh?
I was on our baseball team, played for the state championship, but I didn't play in the games. I was a sub. I could catch fly balls, and I played the outfield. But I batted left-handed, and if a right-hander was pitching and he threw a curve, I couldn't come even close to it.
You're not alone in that distinction. One guy who didn't have that problem is a World War II veteran who would have been playing at that time not too far from you, Teddy Ballgame. Were you a big Boston Red Sox fan?
We're Braves fans.
Boston Braves fans. People forget that the Braves were there. Who was your favorite ball player?
Well, Warren Spahn. I think he was the greatest left-hand pitcher that ever was in baseball. Didn't start in the major leagues till he was 26 and played 22 years. Yeah. Has the most wins of any left-hander. I love baseball. Love to watch it. Like the people that were involved in baseball until the three little steam shovels moved the Braves from Boston to Milwaukee. And then I didn't like a lot of the people in baseball.
Well, Milwaukee didn't get to keep him either, so I guess it's all even now. And Warren Spahn, like you, is a World War II veteran. In fact, a highly decorated World War II veteran.
Yeah, he had a diner that he opened just outside of Bracefield. Spahnies was the place to hang out if you were in and around Boston. He was just a wonderful, wonderful pitcher and a wonderful human being. And then it was a great Johnny Sane. And we won. The Braves won the National League Championship in 48. and lost to Cleveland and that wonderful Jewish shortstop named Lou Boudreau. In fact, he, you know, Lou Boudreau was a guy who created the Ted Williams shift. He had a fifth infielder and only two outfielders because Williams never hit the ball to left field. Williams was a dead pull hitter. Teddy ball game, you know, anytime you challenged him, he was even a better hitter because he would prove that he could hit it even when they pulled the Williams shift. He was a great, great athlete.
Ted Williams, of course, served in World War II as a Marine Corps pilot. He was actually even recalled for the Korean War. Some people don't know that. Warren Spahn survived the Battle of the Bulge. He received a Purple Heart for wounds suffered in the Army in World War II. That other Hall of Famer you mentioned, Lou Boudreau, in case you're wondering there at home, he never entered the service. He was the Indians' player manager throughout that time. I know we could talk baseball for the whole hour here, Mel. I know I can for sure, but let's get back to your story if we can.
So you're born in 1925. That tells me you were 16 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about all that?
Radio. Police station was next door to the high school, and I was a senior in high school. Somebody from police station came running into the high school and telling the teachers that the United States had been attacked at Pearl Harbor. That's how I found out.
What kind of significance did that hold for you at the time? Was it a big deal?
I didn't even know what Pearl Harbor was. But the Japanese attacking us, you know, we were all patriots as kids. Let me tell you, we loved this country. And because our parents and our grandparents, if we were fortunate, have had grandparents that came from this country, they all loved America. My father used to say, only in America, the greatest concept of government ever created on this planet. And he said, you had to hold the founding fathers in awe. How could they possibly have created such a wonderful place?
Well, and there would be some other big American names that you would get to know, speaking of the political realm, but I want to focus on your experience. At age 16 and Pearl Harbor happens, I'm sure you didn't know immediately that you were going to get sucked into this whole thing. But I'm curious, being Jewish and knowing in retrospect now what was happening to the Jewish people in Europe, did you have any inkling at that time that any of that was going on?
My father could understand Yiddish because his mother could speak Yiddish. My father was born in San Francisco, but his mother spoke Yiddish. And for some reason, he could understand an awful lot of Hitler's ravings, which were carried on the radio. And then there was a rogue priest named Father Coughlin who had a program that my dad used to listen to and shake his head and said, I'd like to just have him between my two hands. So we were aware that antisemitism was just rampant throughout Europe, and it was starting to get real bad in the United States because the German Bund was created in New Jersey. There were German Nazis that were parading with flags and, you know, swastikas and so forth. And there were a number of other places that they came to light where Nazi sympathizers. Yeah, we were aware pretty much. My dad, my brother, who was 5 years older than me, we were pretty much aware of what was happening in the world and particularly to Jewish people.
And eventually, you would become part of this when Uncle Sam got a hold of you. But what about your older brother? Was he in the service too?
My brother went in the Navy in 1941, right after Pearl Harbor. He joined the Navy. And all he wanted to do was do something of significance. But he ended up driving an 18-wheel truck and hauling beef for the Navy from farmlands in New Hampshire and Maine down to the Boston Naval Base.
Navy boys got to eat. Your experience was a little different. You ended up in the Army at age 17?
Went to Fort McClellan, Anniston, Alabama for basic training, and then turned 18 while I was there and was offered the opportunity to go to OCS, but I was 18 years old. I mean, it seemed a little difficult for me when I looked around, saw some of the officers that had been training us were older and much more mature. And they also offered me an opportunity to go to college. So I said, I'll go to college. So they sent us to Manhattan College in New York for, we were there for 3 months, and then regimental combat team training they needed foot soldiers in Europe. So back to the infantry.
When you think back on what your mindset might have been back then, did you feel some anticipation of going and doing something? Did you feel some anxiety that you were hoping you wouldn't get too close to the action? What do you think your mindset was as a teenager in the Army?
It's an awful tough thing to say that you might be brave. You don't really ever know that you're brave. You only prove that you can be brave or that you are brave. But I knew one thing. I wanted to kill Germans if I possibly could. I hated them with deep passion. One, because they interrupted my opportunity to go to college. And two, because of what they represented in the world. Yeah. They represented evil. And I think almost every kid from my town that went in the service, and we had a lot of fatalities in my town. One family lost 3 boys, and the 4th son survived and married my high school girlfriend. The Lilja family, I think they were Finnish or Swedish or something, but great. What that family had to endure was... I didn't have to endure anything near what they did and what others did.
You were training here in the States with the 69th Infantry Division?
Yeah. Well, after basic training, yeah. We joined the 69th Infantry Division in Camp Shelby in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And we were training with the Japanese 442nd Regimental Combat Team, who turned out to be extraordinary soldiers in Italy.
And a lot of them were from right in Central California here.
I believe we were the greatest generation. We were called that. When you think about it, I guess the population of the United States was estimated at 130 million at the start of World War II. And our 300 million that we have today couldn't warm up what that generation was able to do. What they produced, food and instruments of war, they were just absolutely remarkable. I mean, how they did it, I don't know. All I know is that I was standing near some kind of a farm in Bavaria. The planes were from horizon to horizon. Our bombers just kept coming. And I remember thinking to myself, where the hell did we get all those planes from? You know, it's unimaginable when you've seen one. You know, how could we have produced all those things?
Especially since there were so few before the war began, and they produced them in such a hurry. Let's talk about how you got over there, because I said that, you know, you were training with the 69th Infantry, but you didn't go over with them.
No, I volunteered to go before.
What were you thinking?
Well, I tried to get in paratroopers, and they wouldn't take me. I wore glasses, and they wouldn't accept you in the paratroopers then if you wore glasses. So I wanted to go fight Germans.
I can't tell you how many veterans have shared this quote with me. The first rule of being in the Army, never volunteer for anything. How did it happen that you volunteered to go overseas?
Mississippi was hell.
And they came around saying, we need volunteers to go over right now?
Anyone volunteer? We'd send you to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and you'd be on a boat.
So that's what happened with the 45th Infantry now?
No, it went over as a replacement.
So you didn't know where you were going until you got there?
I had no idea. The landing had already been made in Normandy. You lived mostly on rumors. You didn't really know where you were going or what you were doing. Who studied the small towns of France? Le Havre and Marseille and Paris, but didn't know the small towns in France. But I tell you what, we had some of the really great generals in American history that started to think out of the box. You know, all our generals from the Revolutionary War to World War II were Napoleonic in education and an outlook on war. But Patton, we moved so fast you couldn't keep up with this guy. Patton really loved his infantry. We all knew that, and we were told that over and over again. He loved his infantry. He wouldn't commit us unless he absolutely had to. And he was a tanker.
So you didn't call him Our Blood, His Guts?
No, not really. First of all, he was semi-god to most of the guys. All all your generals were semi-gods when you're kids, and particularly when you're kids from the country, you know. And I think if you interviewed 1,000 kids, they'd be just like me. You know, you just come out of high school and you go into the service, and there are generals, you know, generals. Who even thinks in terms of generals, you know?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You said you were thinking about the enemy and what you might do to him, and when we come back, we'll find out what duties Mel Friedman had with the 45th Infantry Division. Before we're done, we'll find out what he witnessed in the spring of 1945. And eventually, I think you'll be intrigued by his post-war connection to the Kennedy family. Much more to come on this edition of Hometown Heroes. But first, let me tell you about an opportunity coming up 3 weeks from today. Have you ever been on a submarine? And hanging out with Nemo at Disneyland doesn't count. How about a World War II submarine preserved just as it was in 1945? Well, here's your opportunity, thanks to the Wahoo Base Submarine Veterans. On Saturday, July 13th, you can tour the World War II sub USS Pompanito, part of the San Francisco Maritime Museum. I'm planning to be on the bus, but more importantly, we'll have veterans on the bus who actually served on subs just like the Pompanito. It's a chance to experience history in a very unique way, and you'll also have 5 hours on your own in San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf area. The bus will leave Fresno at 7 a.m. on July 13th, 0700 for you veterans. We'll roll back into Fresno at approximately 9 p.m. or 2100. $69 covers the bus, a tip for the driver, and your admission to the USS Pompanito, that World War II submarine. Ready to reserve your seat? Call Ted Dick at 559-834-2191. That's 559-834-2191. You can't see a World War II sub every day, so let's go explore some history together July 13th.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 88-year-old Mel Friedman is our guest today, originally from Massachusetts. He is a Harvard graduate who lives now in Boca Raton, Florida. We're going to hear about some of the horrific things he witnessed in Europe. Later on, we'll hear about the famous friends he made playing college football. I do want to make a little disclaimer here before we get any further. I know it, in some ways you expect that if you're listening to a World War II veteran remember things he experienced all those years ago, there may be some very graphic descriptions of violence and bloodshed. But in the next 15 minutes or so, we're going to be discussing some of the vicious realities of what Mel witnessed, the kind of brutality and absolute disregard for human life that can really make your head spin and your stomach turn. So if you have children around your radio, it probably is not appropriate for their ears to hear some of the descriptions and the language. As a father, that's something I try to be vigilant about, so I want to give you that opportunity and you that advance warning as well. Thanks for understanding with that. And let's get back to where we left off. You said, Mel, you volunteered to head overseas because you wanted to go over there and kill Germans. But when they assigned you to the 45th Infantry Division, you ended up in headquarters company as a clerk and typist. What kinds of things were you typing up?
Casualty reports and that sort of thing.
Was that a difficult thing to do, to look at the material that you're typing up and realize the human reflection behind it?
No, because the destruction of Europe was almost complete. Every place you went in Europe, it was, you know, just the signs of war and death.
What are the things, when you think back, because I can tell your memory is very sharp, and I can tell that you can still see things in your memory that you saw then. What are those images that really stand out in your mind, things that you went past or saw that just really struck you?
Worst, number one, were the burning tanks at Nuremberg, got hit by the SS and the Tigers. It had already taken place, and we were told to grab our rifles and helmets, but the Germans had already retreated, so we were just looking at burning tanks and the horror of men and tanks. That part of it you don't want to remember. Who wants to remember? You don't want any of your people to hear that somebody remembered arms and legs and so forth. It's nothing that you want to know about. And I think if you talk to young people today, they wouldn't want to know about it either.
I'm certainly not one for graphic, grisly detail, but
on the flip side of that, so many of us can easily go through our life in this country today and not realize how great the price that's been paid for our freedom is, and that people just like us. And was that what you experienced when you looked out at that, that you said, hey, that could have been me over there? That could have been my brother, my buddy?
Of course. Of course, you know, you didn't type a single name that you didn't think it could be you. We were in a barracks in Firth, and we were strafed by what someone said had been a different kind of an airplane. Later learned that it was a jet. One landed at the base while I was there, and as it was being wheeled into a hangar, it exploded, it blew up.
Do you think back on any of the moments you experienced over there and characterize it as a close call, or felt like you were a little too close for comfort?
No.
You felt pretty secure?
Nobody felt secure, but I know it was... Never felt like I was in that kind of danger. You could hear German artillery and mortars with which they were so wonderfully accurate. But what the hell, they measured every inch that we were traversing, so they knew pretty much where you might dig in or where you might have your tanks located. So they, I don't know where they got all the ammunition, but boy, they sure had tons of it. And this is near the end of the war. And they still had anti-aircraft ammunition, which just, you know, you could hear it going bum, boom, bum, boom, bum, boom. The sound of an 88, you'll never forget. No, I can't. I don't want it. I blocked it out of my mind.
That's good that you can. A lot of guys haven't been so fortunate.
Their mortars were even worse. Screaming memes. Germans didn't mine a lot of things, you know, as we were moving across, particularly across Germany. I don't think they wanted to mine their own country. I think they had the mines. We were going through a wooded area, and we found these stone buildings. They weren't very large, about the size of a one-car garage, and with wooden roofs, by the way. And they were all filled with wooden bullets, boxes of wooden bullets. One of our officers at that time said that was against the Geneva Convention, you know, that you could not use wooden bullets, because wooden bullets were just horrifying to even think about. It was, I guess, equivalent to using gas again. Yeah. We were told that if you got hit by a wooden bullet, it just splintered. And there was no way they were ever going to remove all the splinters. But we found two of those buildings that were just stacked with these wooden bullets. Whether they ever used them, I don't know, but I never saw it.
There have been accounts of the Germans using wooden bullets and accounts of Americans having a tough time recovering from wounds produced by such bullets. So that, I guess, was a disturbing discovery for you guys, but there was something even worse than that, something the whole world began to slowly learn about in April of 1945. Just how brutal the Nazi regime had been. How was it, Mel, that you ended up coming face to face with the haunting evidence of evil? How did you end up witnessing a recently liberated concentration camp?
I guess I was the lowest ranked guy in the headquarters company, so I was given a map and instructed to drive Father Kennedy, who was a rotund priest, and as it turned out, he came from Boston. So... And he was just a wonderful man. And I had to drive him to this place called a concentration camp.
Did you know that's where you were going, or you didn't realize it till you got there?
We guessed, you know. We guessed that was someone from either division or army had said that inspection teams had to be sent. I guess so many clergymen, my guess is they just, you know, when they sit at desks and they can ponder, they come up with some awfully creative ideas about who should see these things and why they should see them. I don't think they visualized me seeing it. I think they visualized the priest seeing it. So,
what did you find when you got there? What did you see?
My guess, a football-sized pit. How deep, I don't know.
The size of a football field.
Yeah, the size of a football field. Sideline to sideline and end line to end line. Not goalpost line, end line to end line. I thought it looked like it was even bigger than a football field, but I read later that it was football field size, so I'm using that as a description. But it was just hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of bodies most of them just skin and bones, you know, and but just randomly thrown into this pit. And I believe that most of them had been machine gunned or shot and fell in. And some were probably picked up by others who were going to be shot and thrown in. It had been covered with lime. Someone had ordered lime to be thrown over this pit. But you can't imagine the ovens. We saw, you know, human remains in the ovens and so forth. But that was a couple of other drivers and I walked around while the officers and so forth were... You didn't rub elbows with the officers, if you know what I meant. They were the ones standing around this huge pit, and we saw it and then kind of like moved away, and we went to see the... We didn't know they were there. We saw the ovens, the crematory ovens. We saw the gas. They gassed a lot of people. We saw those rooms. A paratrooper told us that that's where they had gassed thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Another paratrooper was the one who told us you got to see the ovens. And they only had, you know, like, as far as I can remember, like three big ovens. That's all I remember were three big ovens. They were all stone, by the way. They weren't brick or anything. They were stone. And we saw the ovens. And then the people who were standing around, leaning against the buildings and so forth, were just skeleton, you know. I mean, or skeletal.
Alive but emaciated.
Oh, I don't. Emaciated is too simplistic. Oh, they were... Well, I think you saw what happened to some of our troops that were released from German prison camps, who 150, 60-pound guys were down to 80 pounds, you know. Well, can you imagine what these poor people were? They were just there being prepared to get killed. They stripped them of everything, their hair, their teeth, you know.
What did that do to you, especially being of Jewish heritage, to see what had happened?
I didn't think in terms of Jewish. I just thought in terms of how much I hated Germans. I could not conceive, as a kid, and a fairly intelligent kid. I wasn't a dummy. I was naive, but I wasn't dumb. I couldn't conceive of anybody being that cruel to anybody else.
Well, one of the reasons that Buchenwald and other concentration camps are preserved in history with quite a bit of photographic evidence is that our generals made a decision, and you were actually there when Eisenhower was there. In fact, his car passed you on the way into the gate?
His car had to go in before any other car could go in.
You saw firsthand evidence that this gruesome sight was enough to turn General Eisenhower's stomach, huh?
It did. It turned Eisenhower's stomach, and it turned a lot of stomachs. Believe me. I mean, fortunately, I didn't eat, so...
Even though Eisenhower made sure that that was documented, even brought the townspeople in from the surrounding villages to see this.
That I learned from history. I was there just enough for the priest to just be totally overwhelmed and to help him to his feet and to get him to the Jeep and get him back to our outfit. So
you saw all that firsthand, and what I'm getting at, I guess, is there are still people in the world today that somehow claim this didn't happen, or it's exaggerated, or that we're making too big a deal out of this, that 6 million people exterminated. You saw it firsthand. How angry does it make you when you hear someone kind of try to tell a story like that?
Really, there has to be some of our generation left that were Italians, that were Greeks, that were Czechs, or Slovaks of some kind, Polish, because the Germans exterminated an awful lot of people besides Jews. I don't think the Germans took Russian prisoners. That's at least what I heard. So how can you not hate Germany for what they did to so many people? Yes, 6 million Jews was a huge percentage of the Jews in the world. But I just rode on a motorcycle with two friends, and one of them was an Armenian, and I think the Armenians have lost as many people to prejudice as the Jews might have lost in Europe. The Turks have spent 100 years or more trying to rid the world of Armenians, and on one hand, and the Russians on the other, and they were caught in between. Millions of Armenians were slaughtered. Our history books don't tell us these things unless you go to Harvard.
And you did, but you had to get home from the war first. What was that like, coming home? I imagine you had a little different perspective than the wide-eyed teenager that had headed across the ocean not too long earlier.
Yeah, I came to the realization that what I wanted to do more than anything else in the world was to go to college, because very few kids of my generation were able to go. But we had Harry S. Truman and George C. Marshall, and they said any kid that qualified that wanted to go to college would go to college on what would be known as the GI Bill. And what you're holding in front of me, and what you have in front of you, and what Terry has around his office is all a result of that generation being educated. You wouldn't nearly be where you are now technologically if that GI Bill hadn't worked. And if ever any country ever needed another GI Bill, it's us, and we need it right now, because we have a third grade level intelligence in this country. It's pretty horrible.
Let me ask you about your educational experience at Harvard. I don't want to make it about everyone else, but I think you forged some interesting friendships there. For one, you had mentioned earlier the city of Fürth, Germany, one of the places you were stationed during World War II. And it turns out there's a connection there to somebody you met at Harvard?
Yes, he lived right below me at Harvard, and he couldn't understand how a Jewish boy could be a foosball player. His name was Henry Kissinger, and he used to walk with me to the, when I'd go over to the varsity club to eat, he'd walk over to the freshman union, which was next door, and we'd walk together.
And you said, yeah, this guy looks like a future Secretary of State.
No, he looked like a pain in the ass. And he acted like one. And he was very arrogant, intellectually arrogant. He knew he was extremely bright, and he let you know it too.
And Henry Kissinger wasn't the only prominent politician you rubbed elbows with there at Harvard. You're not pulling any punches on us today, Mel. It's break time again. When we come back with 88-year-old Mel Friedman, he's going to tell us about one of his old Harvard football teammates and that teammate's older brother. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with their names. The teammate, Robert F. Kennedy. And, of course, that makes the big brother our 35th president. Mel knew them both very well, and we'll share those memories when Hometown Heroes continues next, right after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Los Banos. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Los Banos is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Los Banos, California.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, reminding you that no matter where you live in this great nation of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and it can be pretty eye-opening to find out what that aging man or woman next door or down the street or around the corner
has done selflessly in the service of our country. It's been a very candid conversation with Mel Friedman. He served in Europe with the 45th Infantry Division during World War II. After the war, like so many returning American veterans, he took advantage of the GI Bill and went to college. And it was at Harvard that he got to know quite well a family that was about to establish a political dynasty. You knew Jack and Bobby Kennedy pretty well, huh?
Yeah, I played football with Bobby at Harvard and for 2 years. And Jack was a rabid fan of Harvard football. You know, at that time, Harvard football, we played, we came out here and played Stanford. We played, you know, a major college schedule. And although I don't think any of the people that played in those days could have been playing today, but...
And you played middle linebacker?
Yeah, I was a middle linebacker. I think I was one of the first people to have a blitz, as you know it today, blitzing. Our head coach, Richard Cresson Hollow, was considered to be one of the great defensive coaches of his time, although he was our head coach. He said to me, you know what, you're so quick off the ball. He said, I'm going to put you at linebacker. And whenever you think you have a chance of getting in the Browns' backfield, do it. Don't wait for me. Just do it. So having played enough football, seeing how linemen block, you know, and tendencies, you know, they have a tendency to lean towards they're going to block. And Brown was undefeated. And that was a team on which Joe Powell was a halfback, Joe Paterno.
You tackled Joe Paterno?
Oh, poor Joe. If you had mentioned my name at any time, just I had to say to him, who was number 24 at Harvard? And he'd say, that SOB. I was in the backfield all day. The Boston Post said I was the difference between Harvard winning and losing. We upset Brown 13-7, and I think I spent as much time in their backfield as Joe did. I don't know if any of these guys are alive. I know Joe Paterno passed away, and his brother, I believe, was older than him, may still be alive. But they did, and believe it or not, my prep school, a close friend named Woody Grimshaw, was captain of Brown, and he was offensive and defensive end for them, and never forgave me for that game.
Sounds like it made you pretty popular there in Boston. And you said that you guys were some of the first to blitz. But did you actually call it a blitz? Because I'm guessing, yeah, that had a different connotation for you.
The next week against Yale, every time I would just take a half a step towards the line, the captain would shout, he's in, which meant that somebody had to account for me in blocking. So Yale beat us 31-21, but that was a tough game for me. I think I was, I had been in the infirmary almost most of the week with the flu, and get out in time to get down and suit up and play against Yale, so I didn't do much in that game. They had a great running back named Levi Jackson, one of the first he was like your Jackie Robinson out here. He was the Jackie Robinson of the East. Wonderful running back. Small, but very elusive. Huge thighs. You could almost not tackle him, you know.
Tell me what happened when Harvard went up to West Point to play Army.
Down to West Point.
Oh, down from Boston, yeah. I'm out here in California. When you went down to New York and West Point on the Hudson to play Army, what happened there?
Vince Lombardi came by my locker and he said, damn, are you small.
He wanted to know who 24 was because he'd heard about your exploits at middle linebacker.
I just played the game against him. He wanted to know who 24 was, and he came over and he said, damn, you're small.
So, but this is Vince Lombardi before he's Vince Lombardi.
Yeah. Under Earl Blake at the military academy.
But it stuck in your mind because this is the wise guy who came over and insulted you, huh?
No, he introduced himself. He said, I'm Coach Lombardi. You'll never forget the face.
Yeah. So then,
long after that, you know, that he ascended to head coaching jobs, and he deserved them. He was a fantastic coach and than a good human being.
So every time you saw him in the newspaper on television.
I was a fan, and when the first Super Bowls took place and Green Bay played in the Orange Bowl, my wife and I were sitting there screaming and rooting for Lombardi, and at one game, Lombardi's daughter sat beside us.
Did you tell her that story?
Yeah, I did.
Did she believe you?
Yeah, but he didn't remember it.
Perhaps he pulled something similar with some other opposing players back in those days. Then just assistant coach Vince Lombardi, and now, obviously, an absolute legend in the game of football. Clearly you remember it, Mel, and I guess that's all that matters for right now. Some good football stories from Mel Friedman, and it was football that would introduce him to an iconic American family. And as far as the Kennedys are concerned, Bobby was on your team, and Jack would be at a lot of your practices, or you'd see him in the offseason or whatever, and those are two guys that people today always wonder, what would they have done had they lived longer? What kind of people were they? And you got a, it sounds like, more than a passing glance at that. You actually knew them and can speak to their character. So what are the things you remember about those two?
Well, my wife and I worked very hard to get Jack elected as a representative first, and then as senator, you know, and then...
What did he used to say about your wife?
He said, I had the prettiest of all the wives and girlfriends on the football team. He was right, too, by the way. But he was just such a dramatically popular and intelligent and leader-type person as you will ever find. We all adored him. And I'm talking about kids from all kinds of backgrounds. And if you were to interview other guys that may still be alive from that football team, and I think there were about 12 or 13 of us still alive, they would all tell you the same thing. He was just a fantastic human being. And Bobby was just a real nice guy. But Bobby was, I would say Jack was the perfect example of an extrovert, and Bobby the perfect example of an introvert. And then Teddy was a freshman when I was a senior, and Teddy was asked to leave school for a year for having violated, you know, one of the honor codes that we had. So I didn't get to know Teddy very well. I had met him, but that was it. He was gone.
I know you would stay connected to that family for many years. I have to ask you about it because it's such a big part of history. Both of those men who you knew so well and thought so fondly of were assassinated. How did those situations impact you? In 1963, when you got that news, what did that do to you?
When Jack was assassinated, someone came into my office and told me that Jack Kennedy had been shot. I didn't know he was dead. And I just, you know, it's disbelief, you know. Who would shoot Jack Kennedy? Come on, you know. Thought maybe it was a rumor or something. So ran for the radios, turned the radios on, and we didn't allow the radios to be played during working hours, but we put them on, and we all heard the jacket. I had to go home, and for 3 days, I never moved from my television set. I just cried, because he was just such a wonderful human being, and he meant so well for this country, believe me. He loved this country as much as I do and as much as Terry does. And that was one of the most emotional experiences other than losing my wife and daughter, of course. That, up to that time, that was the most emotional loss I could imagine.
There's been so much said about him, so much written about him. Is there something that comes to mind for you that maybe is not what people expect when they think of Jack Kennedy, the image they have, something that you can share with us because of knowing him that you would want to share?
Yes, he was extremely generous. A lot of the guys, the men that played football after the war, had been at other colleges and came from places in America that they never dreamed they would ever end up at Harvard. And we were the largest class in the history of Harvard, by the way. There were 1,200 of us accepted that year. Of all the people I met, of all my teammates, all my classmates, the most memorable person of all was not because he became president, but because he was such a really wonderful human being, was Jack Kennedy. I really, truly loved him as a man. You know, he was one damn good guy. All he wanted was what was best for America, believe me. I didn't know any personally about the missile crisis, but I could just imagine Jack in that room when he went in. He said, get those missiles the hell out of there. And he meant it.
What about Bobby? Was he any good as a football player?
He tried so hard. He was so brave. He was... He had little to no talent, but he tried awfully hard. And he did win a letter because he played. He had a broken leg and played in the Yale game, played one play with a cast on his leg. Wow. So he could get his letter. Bobby didn't have a lot to say. He hung out with two or three guys who were on a football team.
Have you been back in recent years to a Harvard football game?
Not for 5 years.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for us to know?
Yeah, Terry Fox is one hell of a guy. And if you don't know it, I do.
Terry is Mel's son-in-law and a recipient of the Purple Heart and Bronze Star for his service during the Vietnam War. Eventually, I'd like to share Terry's story with you on this program. That's one of the questions I get asked a lot, actually. They say, are you ever going to expand to include more Korean War and Vietnam War stories? And that answer is yes. But while our World War II generation is still with us, we're trying to save as much of that history as possible while we still can. There aren't too many people who can tell us with firsthand detail about some of the stuff that Mel has shared with us in this program. Every veteran has a story, and every veteran deserves our thanks. So with that, Mel,
I just want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us those fascinating stories. And maybe you should spend some more time out here in California, huh?
Good Lord willing, I will. But at 88, you don't buy green bananas, you know.
I've heard that one before. And hey, here in Central California, you don't have to. I'm sure there's a few farmers listening from the coast all the way out to the Sierra right now saying, I've got something a lot better than green bananas to sell you, right? So much fresh fruit in season right now, even fresh figs, my favorite. Enough about me, though. Thanks to Mel Friedman for sharing his unique story this time around. Next weekend, we're going to hear from a man who shares his living history every weekend as a volunteer docent at one of our fine museums. You've heard me talk about the incredible aircraft on display at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. It's hard to top the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno, home of the Legion of Valor. The Estrella Warbirds Museum in Paso Robles is definitely worth a stop. And next week, we're going to talk about another one, the Minterfield Air Museum, just outside of Bakersfield. It's a great place to take a trip back in time. And we're going to hear from a guy who not only volunteers there now, but trained at that very base during World War II. That's next week on Hometown Heroes. We're out of time for this one. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.